given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up.
Welcome to Illuminations. I'm Renee Morin, and I'm joined by my co-host, Deanne Phillips.
This is a show about people making ripples in the spirit sphere in the 21st century. From ancient history to modern-day innovations, we are unpacking the stories of all kinds of interesting subjects, people, and events. We're going to the very soul of the matter, and we're bringing it to you.
Diana Oestreich is a war veteran, activist, sexual assault nurse, and the key relationships officer at Preemptive Love. She is the author of Waging Peace, a book she wrote after serving as an American combat medic in Iraq. Welcome to Illuminations, Diana.
Thank you so much for having me here.
I'll just start in by asking you if you can tell us your family history and how it contributed to your signing up for the National Guard.
Well, I grew up in a beautiful rural town in northern Minnesota, and my family has joined the military and served in the military. I think I'm the third generation Army veteran, so it's something that goes back in my family. And I grew up in a small little Baptist church in my small town, and so I really grew up with a tight-knit group of people. And the beautiful thing is it was just a lovely family and a lovely church community to grow up in. And serving was just part of the culture. It was definitely something that was in our family. It was also in our church community, and it was something pretty celebrated. So that's a little bit why I think that when I decided how am I going to make my way in the world, I knew more people who had joined the military than they had gone to college. And so that just seemed like a stepping stone of something familiar that I knew people who had done it, and it really allowed them to go to college or move on to the next thing in life.
You said you never dreamed that your Army National Guard unit would be called up for active duty. If you thought it would you have still enlisted?
You know, that is such a good question, because at the time when I joined the Army National Guard, it still is a state-run militia, and so it's really supposed to be for the state. It's not really supposed to be deploying other places. It was, you know, floods and fires and, you know, just a hometown thing. And so when I joined the military, joined the Guard, the last time my Guard unit had been called up was Vietnam, and that was 30 years ago. And so it just wasn't really the purpose, and it didn't seem like a possibility. So I'm not sure, but I did drive a VW Bug in high school, so I feel like somebody should have told me that maybe. And really, in high school, I'd want to be a medical missionary in Africa, so I really think there were some clues that maybe other people should have told me. There might have been different ways for me to go about this.
When you enlisted, you were only 17. So did your parents have to give consent? And do you think that people are ready for what you had to face at age 17?
No, I don't. Not at all. I think that it is legal to sign up when you're 17, so I didn't need my parents' permission. But I do think that there is a bit of a habit of thinking that going to the military will grow a kid up. And I don't necessarily think that we're handing our kids, because face it, 17 is a kid. Like when I deployed to Iraq, I was 23 and I thought I was an adult, but really 23-year-olds were babies. So I do think that 17-year-olds and 18-year-olds, oftentimes when people sign up, I don't think that they're being given a full conversation about what this means. I certainly didn't. I certainly had no idea necessarily what I was walking into. And those are some big decisions that can change your life forever at 17 and 18. So I don't think that kids are prepared for that. And I don't necessarily think that we're offering them a realistic viewpoint to make those decisions on of what it will mean for the rest of their life, not just for now.
How did you feel when you got that phone call?
Oh my gosh. Well, it was Valentine's Day and I was a college girl, single college girl. So I think when I got an unexpected phone call on February 14th, getting deployed was like the last thing that I thought was going to happen on that phone call. But I do remember when I heard him say, you know, you are being activated for the war on terror. I can't tell you where you're going. I can't tell you when you're coming back, but write a will and put your things in storage.
Write a will.
I just remember everything just stopped. Like I felt like my breath stopped and I could just tell that my life was, this was going to be a before and after. Like after I put the phone down, like my life would be different forever. And I didn't know what was coming. And I knew I didn't want whatever was coming. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how big it would be. I didn't know it would change my life, but I remember feeling like the minute I set this phone down, my old life is gone forever. And I'm going to be propelled into this new one, a new unknown. And I had no control of what that would be. It was an unknown.
Tell us about your first night in Iraq.
So the first night in Iraq was one of the hardest nights of my life. We had just gotten to Iraq, and the very next day we were going to be convoying into enemy territory. And that night we were getting our safety briefing about when, where, and what we'd be doing. And at the very end of the briefing, the sergeant stood up and said, it's a common enemy tactic to push little Iraqi children in front of American convoys in order to stop them. And then they ambush the soldiers at the rear. He said, I hope you understand your duty to keep the convoy rolling at all costs tomorrow. He's like, if you can't do your duty, if you can't keep your battle buddies safe and keep the convoy rolling at all costs, stand up now and identify yourself. Before I could, you know, I just was trying to put together what I was hearing and what that would mean. And before I really knew what to do, whether I was going to stand up and say I wouldn't do it or not, he just bellowed, dismissed. And we all just left. And I remember walking back to my tent, just wrestling, being like, oh God, oh God, oh God, help. Because I knew I had signed up to take a life if I needed to. And I knew that my faith culture told me that this was okay. This was awful, but these were hard decisions. And really I grew up believing that if you took a life for your country, it was ultimately taking a life for God, and it was unfortunate, but it happened. But everything in me just was just crying out to God that I don't think I can do this, but I have to do this. And that was the first time I really felt, I just, in the middle of this night, I just all of a sudden just felt this calm. And I heard this still soft voice say, but I love them, Diana. I love them too. And that's when I knew that I wouldn't ever take a life. And I didn't know what that would mean for me as a soldier in the middle of a war. But I also knew that this was the first time I really had to wrestle with what God was asking of me, which I knew he loved them. He told us to love our enemies. But it was the first time God was really asking me to do something that was different than what my country required of me. And I had this tension. But at the end, I felt like between me and God, I had to say yes to what God was asking me. And he was asking me to love and to protect a life instead of take a life. And so that was my very first night of really wrestling with who's the person at the other end of my theology or my beliefs or my gun? Like, who's that person? And what's it mean for that other person?
At this point, you were still just 23 years old, right?
23! Can you believe it?
Some big issues for a 23-year-old.
Right? Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I definitely felt compelled to write this book, because I was all alone at 23 to wrestle through these big realities that I knew I would never be able to undo. Whatever my decision was, it would change me forever, whether I wanted it to or not.
As far as the nights you spent in Iraq, I mean, would you say that was the one you were the most scared?
Well, if I'm being honest, I was scared all the time. And that was the first night that I think that I was just facing the fear. And I was facing that I didn't know if I would get shot by lunch. I didn't know if I would get raped or tortured. I didn't know what would happen to me in the war. But the only thing I did know was how I was going to show up in it. And so that yes to God felt like taking back some of my humanity. And it didn't change the fear, but I also for the first time felt peace. Like I just felt a deep sense of peace that no matter what happened, I knew what I would do. And that felt like a freedom, even though I was still scared.
And you brought up the fact that you didn't know if you would be raped. But you talk about how since women were just entering the military in active service, being soldiers actually, that being raped even by comrades was a fear.
Yeah, the statistics say that over half of all female soldiers who were deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan were sexually assaulted by soldiers in their chain of command. So people who had power over them. I wasn't scared of Iraqis assaulting me, but I was scared about people who wore my uniform. And it happened on my base. I mean, it was a tent city, wasn't necessarily a base. And so I think that was also a reality that I didn't really have to, I didn't have to accept that reality until I was deployed. But that one was also part of being scared in a war.
You met an Iraqi woman, a grandmother named Am Hassan. I hope I'm saying that right. Am I? Okay, good. Can you tell us about her?
Om Hassan is the woman that changed my life. And I didn't know it at the time. Like all these things happen. You know, you don't know what things will happen to you in the moment. But it was one quiet, dusty, extremely hot afternoon. And I was walking through this village. And all of a sudden, I just saw a little door open and I saw this shadow of a woman. And then I saw the universal hand wave, which in every language around the world, you know, that's somebody who's asking you to come inside. And I remember in a moment, I just froze because I looked around and I didn't have another soldier with me. And this was kind of guerrilla warfare. So you didn't know who was who, and American soldiers were being taken and killed. And so I just knew in a moment, all my training said, like, do not go in that house. Like, nobody will know where you went. Like, they won't even know to come look for you. And what if she's not a nice little grandmother? She's bait. And they'll be the enemy, you know, right behind the door. And so all my training and everything I knew just screamed in my head, act like you didn't see her. Like, keep yourself safe. Like, keep walking. But in the same moment, I just had this, like, fireworks in my chest, and I just kept kind of hearing in my head, like, don't miss this. And so in a moment, I knew that I was going to trust, and I was going to walk through that door, even if I didn't know if it was safe or not. So I walked through the door, and she puts her arms around me and hugs me and brings me in. And that's the beginning of a friendship that lasted my whole deployment, where I got to know her and her children and her grandkids. And the reason why I had reasons to be scared of her, but she had more reasons to fear me. And so for an Iraqi woman to invite an American soldier who had invaded their country, and I had my weapon and all my battle rattle, for her to invite me into her home before she knew if I was safe or not, before she knew if I would hurt her, I feel like that was the first time I had really seen someone offer me the thing I call preemptive love. It's a love that jumps first. It's a love that chooses to trust before you know if that person will harm you or be good to you. But that's just my 2,000-year tradition of following of my faith says that Jesus offered self-sacrificing love and jumped towards us while we are yet still his enemies. So all of a sudden, this woman I've been told to see my enemy is actually putting her arms around me, and she is caring for me and seeing me not just as someone of the enemy or across the world, but she cared for me the same way she cared for her family. And that really changed. That really changed my ability to see how do we love and who do we want to be in the world? Are we going to fight for everybody, or are we just going to fight for our kids or our side? So that Umm Hasan really changed. She gave me oxygen to choose to love in the middle of a war that felt inhumane. Like the fear and the violence made me want to suspect everyone, but she really ignited a new kind of love in me. And it really gave me a breath of fresh air when I feel like I was kind of suffocating underneath all the fear.
Tell us about Umm Hasan's grandson.
Oh my gosh, my heart's gonna beat hard. So on one of the days, and I was a medic, so I would, when my battalion, we were engineers and we were working in the village, I would walk through the homes with my medic bag and just see how people were doing, offer them a little bit of healthcare. And anyways, one day I walked into a home and Umm Hasan really beckoned me over, and all of a sudden the room was just quiet. You know, that tense where you know, like, something is not good. And she unwrapped this little baby. And as she unwrapped him, all I could see were just these like bird-like arms and legs. And in a minute, like, I was a nurse back home before I left, and I knew, I had worked in the hospice oncology floor, and I just knew when bodies are fighting to live and when they're starting to give up. And I looked at, like, no baby should have been that skinny. Like, his fight was gone. And I remember looking at the baby and looking at her and knowing that everybody's eyes are on me. So I remember just looking at her and telling her, I'll be back. And I knew that, I don't know if that baby, Muhammad, her grandson, would be, I didn't know if he would be able to keep breathing for 6 hours or 12 hours, or if I left and came back the next day, if he would still be alive. He was just struggling to breathe, like everything had been used up. And so I went back to my base and I asked if we could bring him for emergency medical care. And everybody said no. Everybody said no. Like, why would we care about that baby? Why would we care about them? That's not why we're here. But a medic, we have a code. And so our code is, if ever life, limb, or eyesight is in danger, we actually have the highest ranking in the battle. Like, we have the highest ranking and authority. And so if ever I feel like I needed to do that, I felt like I needed to do that for baby Muhammad. So at the very last colonel, I just dug my feet in. And after he had told me no, I just kept standing there. I told him that I was pulling rank as life, limb, or eyesight was in danger, because I couldn't say that he would be alive. So long story short, we go back to the village and we collect Umm Hasan and her grandson, baby Muhammad. And we get through the checkpoints and we actually get him to care. And they really do save his life. And at the end, we get to bring him back to the village. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting there, they're passing the baby around like he is just moonbeams and sunshine, and all the aunts and uncles are kissing him and crying. And then these little girls come up to me and they start spraying my hair with perfume, and they start like shoving these like metal cheap rings on my hand. And I was just like, what's going on? And then I remembered in all the Bible stories, when you celebrate, they perfume people and push rings on their hands. So it was this wild moment of celebrating Umm Hasan's family that baby Muhammad didn't die, he lived. And then also connecting back to these stories that I had read that felt so far away, but I was actually closer to those stories than I ever had been before.
I can't believe you stood up to the highest ranking officer.
He didn't like it. And I'm only 5 feet tall. So it also is kind of hard to dig your feet in when you almost look childlike in your uniform.
Wow. That's pretty impressive. So saving her grandson, that had to be a really bonding catalyst.
I knew, because I knew life and death, that if I took that baby with me away from that village and he didn't make it, like, it would not be okay. Like, there's no way, like, we already were told to see each other as enemies. Like, we had invaded the country and there was a lot of violence. So, like, the relationship was tenuous at best. And so I remember knowing that if baby Muhammad lived, then we would be able to celebrate. And if he died, things would never be the same with me and her family, no matter what. And so I think being able to know that Om Hassan had been fighting for her children and her grandchildren to survive, and then to get to be part of that and to celebrate that lives are being saved instead of taken, I feel like that was one of the bonders that I'm just, 17 years later, I am grateful that I got to see that and to be there and to be part of that family celebrating in the middle of all the rubble. Like, they got to celebrate this baby. And the baby was just everything. Like, it was the entire family's hope. And to see that stay there, the joy of this baby and this hope that they were going to fight so that he could have a better future, that was something incredible to describe.
And as a combat medic, you are charged with being able to care for either U.S. soldiers or the perceived enemy as well, right?
Yeah, which not many people know that our code says we fight for life, limb, or eyesight, for every life on the battlefield, wherever we're at. So those are soldiers, that's civilians, that's enemies. And the Geneva Convention actually puts out rules on how prisoners of wars are to be taken care of. And it's really well, which as a U.S. soldier, that is comforting. And also as a medic, that also has changed my perspective, that every single human being on the battlefield was my responsibility to fight for their life. It wasn't mine to divide who was deserving to live or to have care, and who did I leave behind.
That's quite an experience. What do you think Om Hassan overall taught you about the Iraqis?
I think that she showed me that how to really be courageous. She showed me that how to be brave is how to fight for every single person on the battlefield. That she didn't dismiss me because I wore a uniform. She didn't dismiss me because I was from a different country or because I had a weapon. She really taught me how to belong to each other and how to, like, when we're told to see someone as other, she's the one who told me that that's just a superficial, easy excuse not to care. Like, she reached her arms out and she treated me like a daughter who was far away from home, who also needed a family. And so she's the one who showed me that I'm part of a human family and that we're all connected and our roots are bound up together, that what waters your roots waters my roots, that we can't be separate. And so she changed my life. When I was writing the book, I remember I just started sobbing because I remember realizing later that she's the reason why my two sons have a fully alive mom. Like, she's the reason why they don't have a bitter, angry shell of a mom who hates people. That she really, her love put life and more life into me and into my family. And because of her, my sons think that Iraq is the most magical land of the best people in the world, the best storytellers and friends. And they can't imagine not getting to go visit because of how Om Hassan loved me.
You had a very impactful Christmas in Iraq as well when you met Xavier. Can you tell us about Xavier's story?
I remember that it was probably my first Christmas not at home. You know, I was 23, but you always do the pilgrimage home for Christmas. And I remember that day it was cold and it was super wet. Somehow I felt like Iraq went from the hottest hot, and I'm from Minnesota, I know cold, but I felt like it was colder than any Minnesota winter I'd ever endured. And so I remember it feeling cold and wet and dark, and I was just feeling a little pity party for being in Christmas in such a way that never felt. It felt so much farther from Christmas than I had ever felt before. And I remember that usually we needed to be back inside the gates of our base before it was dark. And it was Christmas and it was getting dark and we still weren't back. And I just remember getting more and more worried that something bad would happen, that we'd be hit by an IED or something. And all of a sudden we're rolling on the road and I hear this shout, "Medic!" And I was like, oh no, this is like the last thing that I want to hear. And I remember I was running towards the wounded, and we were getting them on stretchers, and we got them in the back and we started rolling again. And I remember he told me that he was going to die. He's like, "I'm going to die now. Tell my wife that I love her." And just in that moment, when I was taking care of him, like, I didn't know whether he was an American soldier or not. Like, I didn't know if he was the enemy or not. But I know that when he told me, "I think I'm going to die now," which he had gotten thrown from a vehicle and probably collapsed his lung, like, I knew that he was probably right. Like, we're an hour away from camp. And if he couldn't breathe now, like, he was not probably going to make it. But in that moment, when he told me that he was going to die, I remember just feeling that combustion of hope and just almost like, I can't believe this. Like, on Christmas Eve night, like, I am going to let another human being die because I'm going to fail to save his life. Like, that will break me. Like, it was kind of one of my last breaking points. I'm like, if I have to arrive on Christmas Eve night with a human being that I failed to keep alive, like, this will haunt me forever. And I felt like, God, this is like not who you are. So I remember just telling him, I'm like, "Xavier, I don't know what you believe, but I believe in a God of hope and not death. And I don't think he's gonna let you die tonight." And so we just kept working, and I kept saying, "Breathe, breathe." And he did keep breathing. And then he kept breathing for another 5 minutes, and it turned into 10 minutes. And he ended up breathing the whole way back to the tent hospital. And I remember getting him inside, and the other medics took him in. And I just remember feeling like that there's hope, that in the middle of the greatest darkness of this war of Christmas, that God really was doing a miracle in a hopeless pace, because there's no way that Xavier should have kept his lungs going after being thrown from a semi-truck like that.
You said that Xavier was us and we were him. The sparing of his life spared us from all different kinds of death. Can you explain that?
I think it is one of these things that I want to explain, because I feel like in my bones, I know looking at him that he was other. He looked like the enemy. He wasn't an American soldier. And for that, I think we've been told that his life won't affect us. But the truth was that when I was with him, I knew that if he died, that something in me would die too, that I was connected to him in an undeniable way, that his life was connected to my life, and that we both belong to God. And that was the first time that truth just hit me in my bones, that I couldn't separate myself, because he was born in a different country, we're on different sides of the war. Like, I couldn't separate myself from his life, and I had to fight for his life, because really my life was bound up in his. I don't know how to explain that, but I know it's the truest thing that has liberated me to live deeper and wider and more connected than I ever thought was possible growing up.
And you had another turning point when you had to care for a soldier who tried to commit suicide.
In middle of the night, because this is how it always happens, I guess, in my life, or in, I remember getting the call for me, for medic. And I grabbed my stuff, and another soldier had slit his wrists, and I was called to take care of him. And so as I was wrapping up his wrists and taking him to the tent clinic to get sewn up, he had gone in to get sewn up, and I remember just sitting there. And it was a hard thing for me to sit there and see that a sergeant, someone who was one of our leaders, had that moment where he did something I didn't think was possible. And so I think I was just really somber at that, and knowing what it would mean for him, that it would be really bad for him when other people found out. And so I was sitting there waiting, and there's this other guy next to me, other soldier next to me, and he just assumed I was a conscientious objector because I was a medic. And I was just not talking. And he was like, "Oh, you must be a conscientious objector." He's like, "Well, me too." He's like, "Well, I'm not officially one." He's like, "But I love Jesus, and I would never take away another person's chance to know God for eternity." He's like, "So I don't load bullets into my weapon." He's like, "I got a wife and kids back home who I love." He's like, "But I won't ever take away someone else's chance to know God forever." He's like, "I'm a truck driver too," which that was one of the most dangerous jobs in the war, was driving trucks of supplies up and down the roads. They were attacked often. And so this guy tells me this, and all of a sudden, like, there's just like that like fire in your chest where you're like, this is truth. Like, this is like, he's living like he's a citizen of the kingdom of heaven first and everything else second. And I felt like this tension of faith and allegiance and nationalism and patriotism just like blew up in my face when he said that, because I was like, oh, he's free. He is free to love God in a way that I wasn't, like I hadn't experienced. And so he's the one who, after meeting him, I went back to my tent, and I just felt like I wanted the same thing he had. I wanted to be able to love people over fear, and I wanted to live like my faith was more real than just protecting my life. And so I took the bullets out of my weapon that night after meeting him.
If your commanders had known you did that, what would have happened?
I probably would have went to military jail, because there's not options to obey our orders. And I wasn't a conscientious objector. Like, you have to go through a process and apply for that and be granted that. And I had not. So I knew real, and in times of war, everything is heightened. So there's no tolerance for any of that. So I knew I would probably go to military jail.
Did you worry about what would happen if y'all came under attack and you didn't have any bullets in your weapon?
I mean, I was scared of that. I didn't want to see anyone die. But in my head, I just had kind of decided that I would step in front of a bullet. Like, I was ready to step in front of it. I wouldn't shoot at anybody, but I would, if I needed to protect someone, I would just put my body in front of theirs. And I wasn't that, I was scared of dying. I didn't want any of that. And I was always scared, but I also knew that I had something, there's something greater than just to stay alive. And I wanted to be part of that greater love that Om Hassan showed me.
Eventually, you did come back to the U.S., obviously, and you said you felt completely alone. Can you explain that?
I felt like I was a different person. Like, I knew about halfway through the war that the old person I was gone. And I didn't quite know who the new person was, but I knew she was different, like 100% different. And not in the good way. Like, this is not like I thought I had become a better human being. I just knew I was different. And so when I got back, I had this experience of God on the battlefield asking me to lay down my weapon and be a peacemaker. But I knew that all the people that I loved and belonged to, peacemaker was like a dirty word when I was growing up. There were people who just had bad character, or they were seen as people who didn't love America, or they didn't understand sacrifice. And so I felt like a little bit of an alien. Like I was totally different, but I was coming back to people that didn't, I knew I wouldn't belong to them if I told them my battlefield experience. And so I was quiet about my battlefield experience of becoming a peacemaker for 10 years. I really traded my experience for belonging because I didn't want to be told I didn't belong. And so that's the loneliest feeling in the world, to know that the people who love you won't really accept you.
So,
and I also think that soldiers weren't able to, they weren't able to share their experience if it didn't line up with the people they were talking to. And I know a lot of veterans who don't necessarily feel free. They don't feel like they have freedom of speech. They feel like it'll be seen as disloyal or disrespectful. And so they're quiet. And that is a lonely place to be also.
So what were people talking with you about when eventually you decided to take off your service pin when you were nursing?
I was a cancer hospice nurse. And so when I got back from the war, I was there over a year. So I came back and my dad had my combat ribbon. He bought it and he's like, you should wear it on your uniform. And I was like, okay, dad.
Dad's you know, proud.
I don't really know why. You know, like I knew I served. I didn't really think I needed to tell everybody else I was in combat, but I did. And the things that when I'd walk into a patient's room, they would ask me, you know, what's that ribbon? And I was like, well, I was a combat medic in Iraq for a year and I just got back a month ago. And they just kept, they'd say, oh yeah, we got to kill those rad kids over there. And, you know, those people and, you know, you kill anybody and we're giving them hell. And just like stuff that hurt in my bones. Because I knew Iraqis and I knew what they were living under and I knew their love. And so those things brought me back to real experiences, and not one person asked me my experience. They just wanted to talk at me. And I feel like that felt like erasing my battlefield experience. Like they just wanted an audience, and that was also demeaning. And I was, you know, I had just come back. These were very raw things. And I was 23. Well, by that time, I maybe have turned 24. So, like, I didn't know how to process these things, but I knew that it made me feel demeaned and erased and disrespected and talked down to. And, like, they were talking hateful things against real people who I cared about. So I remember that I was like, I'm done with this. So one day after work, I just looked at that pin and I was like, I'm tired of hearing people say awful things. And so I remember taking off that combat ribbon and putting it in the drawer and closing it. And I just, that's, I think when I decided like that part of my life was going to be off limits because people didn't really want to hear or to know. They just wanted for their opinion to be heard. And I was done with that. I had enough to deal with. So that was a bit of a casualty of I shut the drawer and really stopped talking after that.
Are you proud of your service?
I am proud of a great many things, and I'm proud of a lot of people. And I have quite a few Vietnam veteran friends, and they, you know, they wrestle with that same thing. Like, am I proud? For sure. Am I proud of all that was done? I cannot be. So I don't know. It's this both and of accepting that I was part of violence that was not just, and also I was part of building a relationship that was life-changing for me. And so, and then today I have teammates, I have Iraqi friends who their country is hurting, and so I feel complicit and I feel responsible that my country came in 17 years ago to their country uninvited and was supposed to make it better, and the people are still waiting for that better. And so I don't know exactly how to say what I'm proud of and what I'm not. I think there's just like everything, there is a lot of things, you know, they're not one thing. And so there's beautiful things and there's painful things and there's, and I think the important thing is just be able to tell the truth. Like if we can't be honest that we're people who do good things and bad things, then I think we're liars. And I'd rather just say there's both and than feel the need to say that there isn't any bad in what we do.
Which leads me to the next question, which is kind of a mom question. After you married, you had a couple of sons, you talked about how it was, there were some things that were really hard to explain to them. So what were those things and how did you explain them?
Well, for anyone who's had sons, I have two of them. Right around the like 2 or 3 stage when you start potty training is also the gun phase. Like, I don't know if it's just when we start buying them or the fascination hits, but like, it's just a thing and they're just fascinated. And so I was home with my kids and they knew that I had been in a war because they had seen my duffel bag and, you know, so I remember and all those hours where you're in the bathroom just waiting, and he just wanted to talk about guns. And he's always like, what are guns, Mom? What are they for? Why do we have them? What's war? Did you kill people? Like in that 2 or 3 year old, just innocent way. But because I was in a war, I couldn't just do that I don't know, honey, line that you do when you don't really want to explain complicated things that are hard. And kind of painful. But since I decided that I was going to give my kids the truest, most beautiful thing I know, which is the truth in love, I was going to have to tell the truth. And so I just had to tell them. I'm like, well, guns are made to kill. So whether you point it at a person or an animal, you have to be okay with it dying, possibly dying. And he's like, oh, so that's why you don't want me to point it at my brother. I'm like, yes, don't practice. Do something else, you know? And also just having to explain war. So I think that having to explain it to my son, who I wanted him to know the truth, but I also wanted him to have the most amount of hope in the world. You know, I wanted him to know that he had power, that big evil things and scary things, they weren't the biggest thing in the world. The biggest weapon on the planet has always been love, and that he had power to bring love. So I ended up having to explain guns to him and war to him. And then the way that there's no good people or bad people, that, you know, with his little hands, he could choose to hit his brother or he could choose to build up his brother. And he was going to get to make that choice of how he would show up in the world and build people up or break people with all of his amazing personality and strengths and abilities. Like, he was going to get to choose that. So those are some of the parenting things that I feel like I had to wade through, but really helped me out. Because if you can explain it to a 2 or 3 year old, then you finally can explain it.
When your kids went to preschool, you went back to school. And when you you were doing research for a paper and you discovered a certain website. Tell us about that website and what happened.
So I was Googling Iraq and heart defects, and I bumbled on this website that said Preemptive Love Coalition, and it said we're on making violence in Iraq, and this is still, the war was going on. I was home, but the war was continuing. So I remember when I read that, it just hit me like a pile of bricks, and it felt like oxygen that I didn't have to look at my war story as an unfortunate part of my life and turn the page, that I could actually unmake that very same violence that I was part of. And so, you know, whenever you find something cool on the internet, what do? You totally email them and say, oh my gosh. So I was like, I'm a veteran and this is oxygen to my soul to know that we can actually unmake things. We can make new stories between people at odds. And so I stalked them a little bit until they gave me a job. And so I got to come on staff with Preemptive Love, and they're based in Iraq. And so we had to create new stories between people who've been seen, told that each other are the enemy or each other are the problem. So that was amazing for me to get to be a peacemaker in the same place where I had waged war.
What does it mean to unmake violence?
I love this one, Renee, because I'm just like, wow. So I think that whenever an act of violence happens, it can never be undone. We can never delete it. We can never act like it didn't happen. But we can unmake it, which means whatever damage it did, we can restore it. We can build something new out of the old. So one of the ways that we did that was there were Iraqi families whose children had heart defects. And so we helped them get the heart surgery their child needed, but they ended up getting sent to Israel to have the heart surgery. And so this little child would come back to his neighborhood and he'd have this scar on his chest that proved to everybody that somebody that he'd been told is his enemy didn't take his life, but worked to save his life. And so that unmaking violence is actually creating a new possibility and a new story for the future between groups who are at odds.
I'm just wondering, do you think it takes more courage to wage war or to wage peace?
That's a good one.
Well, I know my answer, but I also think that from the beginning of time, people have waged war on each other. So it's kind of like toddlers. Like, they know how to take the biggest piece of cake. It's not hard. You don't have to learn it. It comes pretty naturally. And I feel like that's what waging war is. It's our habit. We don't have to be taught it. It seems like everybody does it. But I believe it is way harder for me to wage peace than it is to wage war. And so, I think we haven't even tried to wage peace instead of war. Like, we have this cycle. And in fact, in American history, we've only not been actively warring or in a war for like 16 years. And so we are in a habit and we hand it to our kids and our kids and our kids. And so I am so hopeful. And I so believe that waging peace in our neighborhoods and in our families means that we are actually going to start to rebuild the broken things. And then we're going to give our kids power to build instead of break. Because every generation, when they get sent to war, it's not easy. And they don't come back without scars. So I think we have to give our kids a better story. We have to tell them there's ways to be heroes. And it's going to look different because we want the future to be different than we've seen, where every generation gets sent to war.
So what is the cost of waging peace?
So I say it in my book, but I'm like, man, choosing to love first. I'm like, that's what I'm arming my sons with, to go out into an angry, violent world. And I don't think they're going to get ahead. And I don't think it's going to make them friends. But I do know that that's the bullseye. Like, that is going to be the thing that is ultimately, like, the cost will be high, but getting to choose yourself how to show up, like, that's going to be the thing that they're going to fall in love with. Like, they're going to fall in love with refusing, saying, no matter what somebody does to me, like, I choose that I'm not going to break somebody. I'm not going to hurt them. Like, that gives them the freedom to build things in life. And so the cost is, it's going to cost them friends. It'll probably cost them a lot of things, but what they gain can never be taken away from them.
You talk about throwing love around like confetti.
I love that.
We really did like that line.
We kind of just blackmailed ourselves. We're like, you know what? If everybody deserves love and if it's our job to love, then we're going to throw it around like confetti, and no longer will it always depend on, do we vote the same? Are we from the same thing? Do we believe the same things? Like, we're just going to start to show up. And I can't tell you how, like, once you make your decision, then you don't have to always be making decisions. Like, we gave our yes, and then it was just a blank check that when people raised their hands in the community and said, we need someone to hear us, or we have a need, we were there. And that's kind of our confetti. And it's just rolled into relationships and places and feeling like my kids belong more to a community than they ever have before.
How can someone support or get involved with Preemptive Love?
Well, we we believe that we exist to end war. And you think, well, how do you do that? But really, war starts with our ideas. They start with fear. And so if you'd like to get involved, please follow along with us on social media, because you're going to hear stories of hope. And waging peace means you get right in where there's tension and where there's violence. Like, you don't have to be scared of that. That's actually the best place to be. And so follow along. You can sign up with us on our website and join us. And if you're going to start to wage peace and go where no one else will go, to loved ones that need help, then it is going to take money. But man, it feels really good to know that you can be part of rebuilding the world, and you can build a better future for not just kids in America, but kids in the Middle East too.
So tell us more about what Preemptive Love, which countries they're working in, and some of the things they do to help the people of those countries.
So we work in Iraq and Syria. That's where we started, really empowering refugees to reclaim their lives from violence. And that oftentimes looks like not giving them a handout, but a hand up, because they already have the skills they need to rebuild their life. And so that looks like businesses, that looks like empowering them to create their own livelihoods. And so we work in Iraq, in Syria, and then also in the US, we do peacemaking workshops. And then when we work in Mexico, because when there were so many refugees at the border, we knew that they need to rebuild their life right where they're at. And we already knew how to do that from Iraq and Syria. And now we're also in Venezuela, because that's where a lot of the migrants really came to Mexico, was from Venezuela. So we're like, let's go where people really start, because that's where they need to rebuild their life. Like, they need to know they're safe. They need to know they have food, water, and their kids have a future. So let's start building that. And then recently, since the blast in Beirut, we're on the ground in Beirut doing food. And now we're restoring people's homes that are right next to the blast.
So what about in the countries where you are making peacemaking efforts? What does that look like?
So first, usually we go where there is violence. And that usually takes away a person's home and it takes away their livelihood. So first of all, like in Beirut, people just needed food and they just needed shelter. And so that's what we do. But after 2 weeks, people really need to rebuild their life. And so we come in with jobs. We think that everybody has the ability to create their own livelihood. So we come in with emergency food fast. And then second, we do jobs. And really that also, you know, there's businesses, but there's also this other part of jobs where we're teaching refugees to have tech skills and to join the worldwide market, where it doesn't matter where you live. If you have these tech skills, if you know how to do QuickBooks, if you know how to do WordPress, if you know how to do website design. So we're really trying to train the generation who got caught in between things. Like, they didn't actually get through school because of the violence, and we're helping them get all the skills they need to have jobs with just their smartphone, so that whether they're moving from one camp to the next or they're waiting for the next thing, that they'll always be able to make an income.
Have you changed your idea of what patriotism means?
Well, I think that I've reclaimed patriotism, because patriotism means I love my country. And I love where I come from, and I can love America. And nationalism is the thing that I started to be like, well, what is it? Because I feel like there's things that I see as really harmful. And nationalism is where you put your country first above all else, and there's no rules. Like, whatever helps your country get first, like, there's no conscience, there's no morality to it. It's just your country first. So I think I can definitely, you know, pull between faith and nationalism and say, you know what, nationalism has no place in my faith. And patriotism does, because we all live in countries that we can say, I'm grateful to be here, while we still don't put ourselves above everybody else at all costs. So I'm trying to reclaim my patriotism. from other things that I wasn't feeling so proud about.
I would imagine that you come across a lot of opposition because it's an unusual approach. Do you ever have people come and insult you about not being a patriot or something like that?
Well, I think I'm a patriot. I'm just not a bigot. So I think everybody matters. But yeah, I haven't actually had that experience. I worry about having that experience. I very much worry about that. But I do think that people who are interested in peace, they're the ones who are following along. Yeah. And I know that it can create tension for people if I say I'm a soldier and I'm a peacemaker. But I think that that's how we grow, is we just continue. So I think I've been fearful about pushback, but I actually haven't had it. And I think also, like, people know when you are for them. Like, they know when you're here with goodwill and you want good things. And they also know when you're just there to be opinionated and shame people. And I'm not any of that. And so I think I haven't experienced much pushback. Because I think we all want good things, and we all know we're not there yet, so we're going to have to try something new.
Diana, where can people find your book?
Ooh, you can find my book at wagingpeacebook.com.
I have one last question, and this is kind of putting you on the spot, but is there any question you haven't been asked that you wanted to answer?
I haven't been asked this, but this is one thing that I think that is overlooked, is that all soldiers believe in peace. We don't go to war expecting more war. So every single soldier believes in peace. So as often as we talk about war, we should be talking about peace, because that's the goal. And so choosing how to show up for peace doesn't make you less of a soldier. So I think that there's this thing that people feel like talking about peace is somehow disrespectful to soldiers, and it's not at all. And so if I could give anyone else a handhold that say it's a good thing to talk about peace, you know, like, you, that is not disrespectful. Like, this is why soldiers go to war, is because they think that we can get to peace. We want something better, and that is not. And so we should all be talking about peace as often as we are talking about war.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Diana.
Thank you for joining us for Illuminations. Tune in next time for another interesting guest and another interesting story.
The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Red River Radio, our staff or advisory board, or of LSUS. Comments and suggestions may be addressed at redriverradiomail@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. This program, copyright 2020. And you turn it around, turn it around, and you turn it around.